My talk is called Work in Progress, a brief history of Wintour's evolution so far. Now, this was a talk that Dharmaloka asked me to give. It's more or less the talk that I gave on the seminar on the new society that Lokeshwara talked about. I was really pleased to be asked to give this talk, because what it did, it gave me the opportunity to look back and assimilate some of the 24 years that I've been working in Wintour's evolution. In a way, it's not my temperament to look back. I'm the kind of person who tends to look forward, looks to the future. So in a way, it's very good that I've been forced to do that. Also, as Lokeshwara said, I've just taken on the challenge, as it were, of becoming managing director of Wintour's evolution. And while I was thinking about that, and also having decided to take that challenge up, it seemed like a necessity to really look back over the history of the business and really try and see what's happened over the years and take stock, really. That seemed really important, to understand the past as a foundation for the future. Yeah. Thirdly, I was really pleased to give the talk because in a way I really care about Wintour's. I wouldn't have stayed so long in the business if I didn't care so much about it. I care about the business, I care about the people in it, and I care about it as an opportunity for people to practice in, people to participate in the new society. So, the history of Wintour's evolution is a very rich and full history. It's a history that involves an awful lot of people. I've not counted them all up, but probably over 1,000 Buddhists have worked at one time or another in Wintour's evolution. I did count up once, it took me a long time. Certainly around about 400 order members have at one time worked in the business, and about 150 order members have got ordained while working at Wintour's. So it's a lot of people, and the business is over 30 years old now. So it's a lot of history. So any history that I'm going to give in the next hour is going to be a gross simplification, and it's also going to be very much from my perspective. What I hope to do is to pick out some themes in that history, and try and draw out what we've learnt from those themes as well. So I'm going to divide this history into three periods, and I'm going to say a bit about each of these three periods, and then I'll say a little bit about a fourth period, the future, really, because it does feel like we're entering a new period in the history of the business. So I've characterised these three periods in the following way. So firstly, the early period of the business, I think, can be characterised by an idealistic struggle to actually set up the business, to establish it in the early 80s. Following that, there was a rapid, almost uncontrollable period of growth that lasted another 10 years up until the late 90s. And then finally, the last 10 years, the last decade, has been one of consolidation and adaption to prevailing conditions. That's lasted the last decade, really. So looking at these three periods in the life of the business, it's clear that many factors have influenced this unfolding history. Some key influences have been the prevailing business environment we found ourselves in, the development of spiritual practice within the business. Also, what's been happening in the wider movement has influenced Wintour's evolution, and then there's the wider changes in society I've been reflecting on, and I've noticed how much they do have affected the business. So one of my observations is that the things that are happening in the wider movement on a macro level, as it were, are reflected in what's happened in Wintour's evolution at a more micro level. So in that way, I hope this talk is not just about Wintour's evolution, it mainly is, but I hope it gives some wider reflection of the development of the movement and what's been happening in the movement particularly in relation to the ideas of around the new society. So, okay, so I'm starting the early period at Wintus, the early 80s, and as I said, I characterise that as a period of idealistic struggle to set up a new business. Yeah. So, starting in London as a market store, the business soon grew and expanded into selling wholesale gifts to little gift shops all across the country. So, Kulananda, Dharmananda, and several others, they had a particular vision when they started up the business. They wanted to raise significant profits to fund the growth of the movement. Kulananda therefore chose to set up a gift business because he saw that in this particular business you could charge significant margins. You could have or you could buy goods and sell them for a significant margin, and therefore there was the potential for substantial profits. So as well as choosing this business, he was keen really just to fund the new institutions that were developing in the movement. Many of the other businesses at that time in the movement were run more at a subsistence level. They were more focused on providing work for those in those businesses. So Kulanad had quite a particular vision. Another thing was that he chose not to adopt the cooperative model, but he chose something sort of midway between this and a more conventional business, more conventional business model. And he also obviously wanted to incorporate some of the ideas that Banti had been talking about the new society. So that was the intentions in starting up the business. So I arrived in Cambridge in the early, late 80s, 1986, at the tender age of 22. And I found a business in which, everyone lived in the same house. There was about 10 of us. We all lived in number 17 Newmarket Road, Cambridge. It was a single-sex men's business, and we very much adhered to the single-sex principle. All but one of the people who worked and lived together were over 35. Sorry, were under 35. there was just one person who was over 35, so we were all relatively young. Yeah. We all lived on the same basic level of remuneration, which we call support. And we very much embrace the aphorism, give what you can, take what you need, as you're all familiar with. That was the mantra of the time. And the emphasis was very much on give what you can, maybe less on take what you need. People worked very hard at that time, often very long hours, sometimes 6 or even 7 occasional days a week. Particularly the van salesmen, they'd go out for a week selling around the country, they'd come back and then they'd go out again the next week. So people worked very hard. And also the business very much depended on and revolved around Kulananda. Kulananda was very focused and committed, very determined to make the business a success. I sometimes think it's easy to forget how difficult it is to set up a business. The failure rate of new businesses is very high, and the initial years of setting up a business demand a lot of the founders. But in a way, the ethos of the movement at that time strongly supported the heroic, pioneering spirit. And there was a lot of youthful idealism and energy about at that time. And of course, we had Banti's vision of the new society that very much sparked the confidence, the faith of those in the business. So the emphasis was definitely on virya and shraddhar, energy and action. I was thinking about this. If I was asked to characterise this period in Wintus's history in more mythic terms, then I definitely say it was very much the time of the heroic ideal. That was the dominant myth, energy, throwing ourselves in and being inspired by the heroic ideal. So looking back to this time, I can see from this, my perspective now, that sometimes the ideology of the movement was adopted in a rather crude, maybe literalistic way, a bit unthinking and naive. Sometimes I would say it's even used to rationalise negative mental states. There was often little time to really reflect how these aphorisms, like responding to the objective situation, well, what did that really mean? How did that really help one's development? There were no right livelihood meetings at that time, and few sort of supportive structures to really support a collective dialogue and reflection for those within the business. However, personally, despite these limitations, I really felt I thrived in this context. You know, as a young, very emotionally immature man, idealistic and energetic, in a way it was just what I needed. Yeah. That was not to say in these early days, you know, I was always happy. In fact, I remember being quite miserable for the first year or so. And I struggled. But I think looking back, it was just what I needed. I was very much caught up in what was a very exciting project. Yeah. It was something very special and unique. It was a business that was ethical and had, you know, an uncompromisingly altruistic vision. So also as a new and growing business, it was something that I could personally influence. Yeah. I felt I could play my part in moulding and shaping what was coming into being. I could very much see the consequence of my actions. I could see the vision that we were inspired by becoming manifest. Also, on a more personal level, as I engaged with the project, my immature mental states were reflected back. Generally, I would say, in a very kind and patient way, by the order members who were involved at the time. So gradually I began to see my own mental states for what they are and take responsibility for them. So this kind of experience meant that my confidence grew really in work. Work really combined with reflection, my confidence grew that that could be a sort of purifying agent, it could transform me. So I feel really grateful. Looking back, I feel really grateful for that opportunity to just throw my youthful energies into something that I could unreservedly believe in. Something that I believed had could have a positive impact on the world, even in a quite a radical way. So I think without that, I think my life could have been quite a mess. So looking back, I feel very grateful. Although these supportive conditions might not have been perfect, on the whole they were very positive, and I just feel very lucky that Wintrust Trading, as it was called then, was in existence and I could engage with it. I mean, looking back, an image that really captures what that time meant for me was that the image of a surfer. I felt like I was a surfer catching that perfect wave. That one that goes on for a long time. And I could just about ride that wave. I had just about had the skill to stay on that wave. And looking back, I think it's carried me a long way. And for that, I feel a lot of appreciation. So, I've just said something about that first period in the history of the 80s. I'm going to move on now to the second period, which really runs from about the late 80s, continuing on to the late 90s. And as I said earlier, I characterise this as a period of rapid and almost uncontrollable growth, if that's what it felt like. So over this decade, from the late 80s to the late 90s, the business grew from what might be regarded as a small to a medium-sized business. From a turnover of about £500,000 to a turnover of £10 million. Several of those years, we grew more than 30%. In one year, we grew over 40%. So it's very rapid growth. The number of the people involved in the business during this time mushroomed from the 10 people that were there in that community when I first arrived to well over 200 people by the late 90s. Finally, as well as it being the business growing very quickly, I think this period was the real start of the business as a team-based right livelihood, which is maybe not quite what it was before. So there are several important conditions that I think enabled these developments to happen, this growth to happen. And I think they're significant in some ways. So the first thing was there was a new style of leadership. In the late 80s, Ruchiketu and Vajuketu took over from Kulananda to guide the business. At that time, Ruchiketu and Vajuketu were very much two energetic and idealistic men who had a very strong friendship formed in what might be called the legendary days of Friends Building Services at the LBC. In a way, the Friends Building Services was the first business really, I think, to earn very substantial amounts of profit to help fund the renovation of the London Buddhist Centre. So Ruchiketu and Vajuketu had some experience. They had a lot of energy and idealism. And along with Kuladitya and Satchaloka, they formed a management team and really began to exemplify working as a team. They began to exemplify collective decision-making, discussing things and making decisions together. Vajuketu very much forged ahead as managing director and very much having a keen eye to business opportunities. Ruchiketu, much more focused on asking the question, well, what does work's practice really mean? Yeah. How can you make work a practice? How can you make that effective? And together they worked in a very complementary way, and they formed a very good team and really established a very friendly and kindly ethos in the business. They established what you might call an ideologically tight ship, and which was very true to how they viewed Banti's vision. So that was the first thing, a new kind of leadership. Secondly, there was, well, as I hinted at already, there was a strong emphasis on the business being team-based. Ruchiketu, as a sort of Kalyana Mitra to the business, he basically noticed that, well, he started off just having one-to-one time with people, going for walks and things like this. And that was important in its own way, but he saw that there were some limits to that. Limits in terms of engaging with people and their practice. So therefore he experimented with introducing the idea of a right livelihood meeting. I'm not sure whether there were right livelihood meetings before, but Ruchiketu really took up this idea and explored it very fully. So he established right livelihood meetings for all the teams within the business, and he really encouraged members of those teams to talk about their practice at work, how they were able to bring their spiritual practice into the work, how they related to the task at hand, how they communicated with other members of the team. Yeah. So this gave the opportunity also for team members to reflect back each other what they saw, how people, the mental state, how people worked. And people were seeing, because they were seeing a lot of each other, 7 hours a day, they saw each other in lots of different ways and were able to reflect back and then much more fully. So in these meetings, quite intense dialogues often emerged. And although the communication was often not that easy, it really felt, I remember in those days, it really felt we were getting to grips with each other spiritually. So that was team-based. The business becoming more team-based, I think, established a basis for the growth of the business. Then there's another aspect I think Ruchiketu brought to the business at this time, and this was really reflection. Ruchiketu reflected a lot at this time on Banti's teachings and how they could really be practically applied in the work context. So he experimented with lots of approaches to help facilitate engagement with work as spiritual practice. And following on from this, there were lots of discussions in meetings, and lots of really creative ideas emerged from that period. For me, this is very significant. I think what Rishikata initiated was the application of intelligent reflection to work as a spiritual practice. It wasn't enough just to throw yourselves in. Yeah, I think that was shown at that time and even since then, that that isn't sustainable. Just energy, just throwing yourself in on its own. As we know, people just got burnt out. So I really feel grateful for Rishikata in this way, that he explored and developed tools, models and ideas, really just thinking, that really helped people get more out of their spiritual practice at work. He looked at sutras, which were useful. There's the one about Gataka the potter, which is quite interesting. And then he also took up ideas. For example, in the seminar that Bhante did on the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Bhante encouraged all the members to think of, well, are there other Dharma doors to non-duality that we haven't thought about that might be more relevant to our current experience? So Rishikata at this time, looking at how people communicated, saw that people tended to polarise between two extremes of either rigidity in their communication, holding views very tightly, or going along, being passive and compliant. So he suggested that people could be both firm in their views but flexible. And this seemed to have a resonance at the time. It was fruitful at the time, and it helped people to expand their communication within teams. So he took Dharmic ideas and explored them and expanded them. And also, he also took ideas. He wasn't afraid to explore ideas from modern management ideas and just see if they helped as well, test them out. So you probably all know, can't remember where this comes from, but there's an idea that there are stages in the development of teams, forming, storming, norming and performing. You've probably heard of that. And in some ways, some of these are a bit glib, and I don't take them too seriously, but they were helpful. They were very helpful at the time, because sometimes you're in a team and you thought, oh, this is hell, you know. How can I get on with these people and communicate with them? But it's very useful to think, well, okay, this may just be a stage in the development of the team. If I stick with this, well, we slowly get to know each other, and you slowly begin to work better and in a more fruitful and healthy ways. So some of these ideas were very useful. So, as I say, that's Rishikata introduced, I think, intelligent reflection to the practice of right livelihood. At the same time as this, there was a very strong supporting ideology within the movement more widely towards engaging in what was then called the three C's. To engage with community living, right livelihood, and centres. And particularly this injunction was coming strong from ordination teams, like the ordination team at Pamaloka. And another area where this came there was a new kind of confidence and encouragement to engage in right livelihood came from a seminar that a number of us did with Bhante in 1991. The Winter Seminar. This was a very interesting seminar and a very interesting time, really, at the beginning of this period of rapid growth. I remember at the time we spent a lot of time talking about the idea of, well, how far can practice in right livelihood take you? And in a way, a number of us at that time thought, well, you can go so far with right livelihood. Maybe it's good for integrating one's energies. But the idea, but could we go further than that? Or did you need to go off and meditate up in a mountain? Did you need to meditate more of your time to actually go further? And there was a lot of talk about insight at the time. So we went with a lot of questions to see Bhante, and how Bhante responded was very interesting. I tend to think we misinterpreted some of the things that Bhante said. But his message was very clear as well, that in a way, What was important was strong engagement and clear thinking. He was saying basically he thought you didn't need all of the dhyana factors to hold you in a place to make use of insight experiences. One of the things he was saying, you can't say that a particular lifestyle or particular mode of lifestyle actually takes you directly to insight. Insight can happen in lots of different ways, lots of different experiences. But the things he emphasised in the seminar was engagement in what you're doing, strong engagement with what you're doing, and bringing at least a sense of one-pointedness, ekaggata, to one's experience. So I could talk and talk about that seminar, but I'll stop there. But in a way, I'm mentioning it because it gave a lot of confidence to what we were doing, and in a way, a strong encouragement to engage in right livelihood, team-based right livelihood. A couple of other things that supported the growth I'll mention briefly. There were a lot of youngish people around at that time who just wanted to get involved. They wanted to get involved. And also at that time, there were several women who wanted to join the business, and we made a decision to open up the business so that women could join as well. Although at that time, we very much maintained single-sex teams. So that was important, that there were people who wanted to engage in right livelihood. Finally, in a way, on top of all this, we happened by chance to stumble upon a niche in the retail market that was growing. Unwittingly, we had found ourselves in a position where there was an expanding demand for gifts in our strange economy. So as a consequence of all these conditions, the business grew very rapidly in the 90s. In 1988, we opened the first Evolution shop. It was very financially successful and was quickly followed by an expanding chain of shops across the UK and then in Ireland. And there were also a couple of independent Evolution shops in Spain, Germany, which we supported as well. So by the end of the 90s, there were actually 18 Evolution shops. I think in Evolution, we created a business and right livelihood model that could quite easily be replicated. It was a business model that was operated in association with local Buddhist centres and enabled many people to engage in team-based right livelihood. Buddhists with little training could work together and raise substantial funds for local centres. So all this led to quite a significant financial success. When I was looking into this, most of the Buddhist centres in the UK benefited from this financial success. And several Buddhist centres like Nottingham, well, they probably wouldn't exist if there hadn't been an Evolution shop. So as well as this, the financial side of things, all this helped many people to deepen their experience of the Dharma through working together with other Buddhists. It helped many people get ordained. Also, I think that experience is the basis of many, many deep and long-standing friendships which nourished the movement right through to today. So the financial benefits of this period of growth, I think, are significant and important in helping establish the institutions of the movement. But for me, much more important has been this opportunity for Buddhists to work together, to practice together. It's not just coming together for an evening, not just coming together for a chapter meeting or even for the length of a retreat, but working together for 7 hours a day, 5 days a week. You just get to see more of someone else. You get just to see people in their range of their character and their personalities. I mean, I know for many people, even for me at times, working in Evolution at Wintours has been a very challenging experience. You know, running a business is very difficult, and especially so, it's even more difficult running a business along the lines that Banti has outlined, making collective decisions, cooperating together, living by the precepts, and also accommodating very many different characters. At the beginning, in this period, we took on anybody, really. We didn't filter. We didn't. The interview was something that I don't think existed at that time within Windhorse Evolution. So, although it's difficult, this period, for me, it felt very worthwhile. As I say, I felt I really got to know people quite deeply and form very strong friendships. In a way, it just felt very important. I was both challenged by the work context, but really held by strong friendships. And that combination, I feel, is very dynamic in terms of spiritual practice, at least for me. So I feel very fortunate to be been involved at that time. So looking at this period, the second period of rapid growth, I think the dominant myth of this period, I didn't have to think about this very long. For me, it's clearly building the Buddha land. Yeah. Building the Buddha land was this the myth that was dominant at that time. And it was this myth that drove us to make money for the movement and also fashion the normative way we lived at that time. We really felt we had something that could change the world, something special. And the success, both financial and in terms of people deepening their practice in the business, I think confirmed that that faith and gave us a lot of confidence. So during this time, at least in Cambridge, the Windhorse community was fairly homogenous. Yeah. So just to be clear, nearly everyone in the business in Cambridge lived in single-sex communities and had fairly standard norms in terms of practice, morning meditation, community evening, etc. That was fairly standard. I mean, the vast majority of the people who worked in the business were also on support. Yeah. Apart from one or two people who had particular skills, everyone who worked in the business was Buddhist. Yeah. And also, at that time, there were lots of collective rituals, meetings, talks, lots of activities that everyone, or pretty much everyone, engaged in. So all this very much reinforced a very strong sense of community and a coherent community. In Cambridge at the time, one of the words that was used to describe this particular lifestyle was that it was semi-monastic. Yeah. And again, the ideas here were very much linked with Bhante's seminar, and there was a confidence that this lifestyle, living, working together, could, along with things like retreats, could meet all one's spiritual needs. That was the idea at that time. So this was very much a situation where there was an intensity provided by strong engagement with work and collective practice. There was a really strong faith in the efficacy of team-based right livelihood as a spiritual practice. But I think also I do need to mention that in a way there was a darker side to this period in the history of the business. In a way, I don't want to overstate this, but also I think it's important that it's not left out. Well, there was a rapid expansion in the business, as I've mentioned. This was often really chaotic, and it led to very high levels of stress at times, especially amongst those in the management of the business. We often really didn't know fully what we were doing, and this especially sometimes entered into the area of interpersonal communication. And some things, you know, were quite difficult and painful for people. So I think this sort of stress, all these things I've just mentioned, were exacerbated by some negative tendencies in the business at that time. So I think there was a little bit of arrogance sometimes, and a little bit of being closed off from outside influence. Again, I don't really want to overstate this, but I think that was there to some extent. And I think that was partly born of the financial success of the business. That gave us a certain confidence, but I think sometimes an overconfidence. And also, as I mentioned, I think I think to some extent, some of what Bounty said in this seminar was taken in the wrong way. But I won't go into that now. Also, I think at times we held on to some of the ideology of the in a too rigid way, really. There were certain ideologies within the business we that in a way we held on to at the expense of really responding kindly to individuals. Yeah, at times. Responding to individuals' needs and what was happening with them. The one example here that is very clear in my mind is, I think we hung on to what was then known as no sex in mandala principle. So some of you might remember this. In a way, there was a concern of what we had. As I mentioned, it's sort of semi-monastic situation. We were concerned, there was a fear in what would be the effect if people got involved in sexual relationships. But I think we hold on to that idea out of a fear of the negative consequences. But, you know, experience has shown me that I think there are forces here that you can't hold down, you can't restrict. And I think it was inappropriate that we hung on to that principle in encouraging people to stick to that idea. Repressed emotions always find an expression, and sometimes in unhealthy ways. So for me, there's a lesson there around holding on too tightly to ideologies. I think at times we were also on the edge of encouraging, even pressurizing folk to engage in the collective practices, like things like morning meditation. Another aspect that I think we were limited in at that time was not recognising that different people have different temperaments and personalities, and therefore they need to engage differently in right livelihood. So some of the collective approaches of that time really didn't consider that there were those differences. Yeah. So for example, a friend of mine, Padma Siddhi, he found it quite difficult when there was this idea of the path of responsibility. Some of you will remember this. The idea that through taking responsibility externally and internally, you could progress spiritually. I think it's, in a way, basically a sound idea. But in a way, it was communicated at times in a way that, like my friend Padma Siddhi, felt, well, he didn't want to work like that. That wasn't the way he engaged. But he felt was there something wrong with him? Because he didn't want to engage in that way. So for me, there was a lesson there that people will engage in different ways, and you need multifaceted approach to help people engage with right livelihood. Lastly, I think there was difficulty sometimes because certain things weren't understood really. For example, I think there was unclarity about the difference between spiritual experience and business competence. So, really, spiritual experience cannot compensate for lack of business competence. And sometimes I think we thought it could. And that caused people difficulties. So, as I say, I don't want to overstate these negative aspects that in a way came out because of the rapid growth of that time. But I think it's really important to acknowledge these and also acknowledge that they did cause some people suffering and some heartache. And I think it's useful to reflect on these and understand these lessons for the future as well. So I want to move on now to a third period, the late 90s until today, really. So as I say, I characterise this as a period of consolidation and adapting to prevailing conditions. So by the late 90s, it was very clear that we all needed to slow down. We needed to slow down the growth of the business and in a way catch up with ourselves. It was very clear we could no longer continue to grow in the way that we've been doing for that previous 10 years. The initial impetus for this decision to consciously stop growing and consolidate came from within the business. So one thing that we were very aware of was that the management team was worn out. You know, we were overworked and stressed, and I think many of the other people in the business were likewise experiencing these kind of effects from growing very rapidly. So as well as being overworked, we realised we were insufficiently trained and experienced to take some of the responsibilities that we were. Rapid expansion and lack of business management skills also meant that we hadn't delegated enough. So as well as this, organisationally, the business was undeveloped. Basically, our organisational structures were not developed enough to support a business that had grown from a small business to a medium-sized business. We'd grown in a very chaotic, inefficient and unplanned way. And then thirdly, there was really a bit of a crisis of vision, really. Somehow, the myth of the building the Buddha land wasn't quite working anymore. There was a kind of question, well, what's the point of building a new society if it's leaving us stressed out, in bad states, and not enjoying ourselves? So the question arose, well, what's it all for? Yeah. In a way, maybe this was the business having a midlife crisis. Yeah. So management worn out, organisationally undeveloped, and a crisis of vision. So as well as this more internal impetus to slow down, along with these issues, there were other factors that emerged that forced us to consolidate and adapt to prevailing conditions. And these were really broader currents and influences that were there in the movement as a whole. I'm sure you'll be familiar with these. So we were in a period of questioning and doubt. The Guardian article, Yashimitra's letter, and many other issues led people to question Bhante, question his teaching, question the movement. In particular for us, the dominant ideology in the movement promoting involvement in the centres, in communities and team-based right livelihood was questioned. Yeah. And this strongly affected our ability to recruit Buddhists into the business. Secondly, I think ageing. We're all ageing. As I said, when I arrived in the business, we were all very young. By 2000, many of those in the business were approaching or over 40, in their 50s. So people were questioning what they were doing with their lives. And this led many people who had just thrown themselves into the business in the previous decade to decide to move on. There's been an interesting consequence of this for me personally. A rather strange position I found myself in as personnel director, and that was of almost having to encourage people to leave the business. Normally I think personnel director would be trying to keep people within the business, but often actually I saw that it was time for people to move on. Yeah. It's okay to leave, it's not a failure. In a way, I think I often found myself needing to say, well, team-based right livelihood doesn't need to be a lifelong commitment for it to be efficacious. I mean, looking back, I think I can confidently say that for the vast majority of people who have worked in Windtour's evolution, I think they've benefited from that involvement. But I think for many of those in the business, there was a natural shelf life for that benefit. Yeah. It was a good thing for a while, but they needed to move on. So as I say, there was a period of people of reassessment, thinking about things and moving on. So finally, in terms of the wider things that were happening in the movement that affected us, I think there was a reaction to what I've called the perceived in fact, forced collective. So there's a reaction to the perceived force collective. So the environment of questioning and doubt mentioned already, I think, allowed a reaction to emerge where people had gone along at an earlier time with the dominant ideology and the normative lifestyle at Windtour's, but people hadn't really fully bought into it.
Yeah.
So looking back, I think in particular, often people engaged, but once they were ordained, what emerged was that people had gone along with things partly to get ordained. Often this hadn't been fully conscious at the time. So as well as this leading to some people leaving the business, this was also accompanied by understandable feelings of anger, feeling let down, and sometimes feeling very critical of the business. Yeah. So often this combined with objective cases where maybe people had been unskillful to people within the business. I think mainly that was often due to a lack of understanding or awareness. But in a way, the objective and subjective factors mixed up. And this meant that it was quite a difficult time, particularly for the management of the business at that time. It was sort of people realising and having reactions of various sorts. So all this affected the business. All this forced Wintours to change and adapt. Yeah. So I think the last 10 years has been quite a transformative period, really. Our transformation over this period has been very thorough. Yeah. It's taken longer than anticipated. I don't think at the beginning of the last decade, we didn't think that it would take 10 years. But we couldn't have anticipated what the last 10 years has held. So I'll just say a little bit about that transformation. Organisationally, we've worked steadily to improve the management structure and training within the business. We now have well-developed personnel, health and safety, induction procedures, for example. We also have a dedicated Mitra convener, a welfare officer, a learning and development manager to cater for the needs of those in the business. Yeah. In 2002, we moved to a purpose-built warehouse, very pleasant offices and efficient warehouse facilities. We even changed our name to Wintours Evolution to bring the two sides of the business together. So in these and in many other ways organisationally, we've caught up with ourselves. And and I think we very much now have these structures and organisation to support a business of our size. So as well as organisationally, I think we've made cultural changes. I believe that we've really developed in terms of creating a more mature, aware and kindly ethos within the business. I think we have absorbed and assimilated a lot of the lessons of the past 20 years or so. I mean, an example here is that differences and difficulties in the business tend to be resolved very quickly these days, whether informally or informal mediation. Yeah. We've also broadened the senior management of the business. There's a larger number of people involved in the senior management. And I think that's relieved pressure on certain individuals and also led to a broader sense of collective ownership of the business. Rat Negotia in particular has been a key player in some of these developments. As a consequence of all these changes, my strong impression is that people are happier and healthier than they have been before. Few people overwork, and very few people work beyond our standard 35 hours a week. People also have much more varied lifestyles of those working within the business. There are still many people who live in communities, but it's not so much the monoculture of community living that it was before. Each community is very much autonomous and very much has each community has a varied ethos. Also, the choice in relation to lifestyle, I think, has very much hands responsibility back to individuals. And what I see this means is that the Buddhists who are still working in Wintours is very much there because they really want to be there. Yeah. They've chosen to be there very fully. So, as well as organisational changes and cultural changes, We've also had to adjust to fewer Buddhists wanting to work in the business. The factors that have been outlined so far have meant that during the last decade, it's been much more difficult to recruit Buddhists. Yeah. So for a number of reasons, we've also not been able to downsize the business. So that's meant we've had to recruit more non-Buddhists into the business. So now, for example, non-Buddhist teams run all but four of the Evolution shops. So we've got 17 shops, but all but four are run by non-Buddhist teams. In Cambridge, it's still very much a strong Buddhist ethos. 75% of the staff that work in Cambridge are Buddhists. So all this change has meant we've had to adapt as well and create different supportive structures for these people. But as I say, for me very much the business is still very much a Buddhist-led business, and in Cambridge in particular there's very much a strong Buddhist ethos. Those people, those non-Buddhists who work with us, and very interesting enough, we don't find it difficult at all to find non-Buddhists who want to work with us. They're very much people who share at least some of the elements of our ethos. Very interesting that the non-Buddhists are often very prepared to take a much lower wage than they could get elsewhere, because they want to work in the kind of business we have. So looking at this period, the last 10 years, it's been a very challenging time, very, very spiritually challenging time. And in a way, we've struggled to find a collective myth that unites the business. In fact, possibly the thing that characterises the last 10 years is a retreat away from the collective towards the individual. That might be the way you characterise this last 10 years. Personally, I don't see this as entirely a negative thing. Personally, I think it was part of the catching up that needed to be done. Certainly, the business has responded in a whole range of ways and much more fully meets the range of individuals' personal needs, the varied personal needs of those working in the business. For example, you know, training and welfare needs. We're much more responsive to particular people. We understand different temperaments, I think, much more, and able to engage, help people engage in that livelihood in different ways. So finally, I just spend a couple of minutes just talking about the future. Well, what does the future hold for Buntos Evolution? Well, thinking about the future, I believe there does need to be a stronger collective myth if the business is to survive and flourish. Yeah, I definitely think there needs to be a stronger myth. However, I don't think this can be one sort of single rallying cry, as it were. I think the vision and the collective myth of the business needs to be a bit broader and more multifaceted. It needs to be based on individuals, meeting individuals' genuine social and spiritual needs, needs that are met in a sustainable way. We need to maintain the ethos of individual autonomy and voluntarism. And there needs to be different avenues for people to engage and make something of workers' practice for themselves, make it meaningful for themselves. But I think it also needs to demand more of us as well. I think we need to move beyond our own individual needs. I think for me, personally, spiritual development crucially involves a shift towards the selfless, a reorientation to a more altruistic mode of being, to being more guided by the needs of others and allowing the Dharma to flow through us. Right livelihood, I think, needs to be about a gradual realignment of ourselves towards the Bodhisattva ideal. So recently, within the business, we've been reviewing the collective vision in lots of different contexts. And a number of key points, key themes have emerged around which I believe there's a high high degree of consensus and common feeling. So I'm not going to go into those the details of that vision here, but I believe they provide a coherent basis that can carry the business forward. We are, I think, a friendly and mature community that I think can provide an excellent context in which to practice. We have a diverse sangha that are alive to the opportunities within the business. And, well, while many people in society, even some people I think within our movement, are forced by necessity of earning a living in areas that are maybe ethically dubious, questionable, in a way Wintours provides ethical work with an uncompromising and altruistic vision and goals. So just to finish, well, in a way I want to share you, I'm personally a keen gardener, yeah, and so I've been reflecting about how gardens develop and grow. And one of the things, if you know anything about gardening, is that the really great gardens that you see around in Cambridge, if you go to one of the colleges, you see some really wonderful gardens. And if you talk to the gardeners, they will they'll tell you that it really takes decades, not just years, decades, to really develop the finest of gardens. So I think over the last three decades at Wintours, we've learned a lot about how to lay out a garden, what works and what doesn't. We have seen some plants grow very quickly, and we've also seen some wither. One of the things I remember talking to Sangadeva, who is one of the great gardeners in the movement, he told me that the most important thing about a garden is the soil. Yes, to have a successful garden, you have to have a very rich, fertile soil. So one thing that I feel confident about Wintour's evolution is that we've developed a very rich soil, yes. So I think that creates an environment in which to grow, and I believe that's an environment maybe better than it's ever been. So I very much hope we can attract Buddhists to join us working in our garden. I hope we can continue to enjoy working in the garden, not only enjoying our labours, but also enjoying the fruits and flowers that result.